This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Student protesters want their universities to sell off investments in companies that have businesses or investments in Israel. But what does Ohio state law allow? On our weekly news review today, we'll talk about what the Ohio Revised Code has to say about divestment. Plus, how much is Hamilton County willing to pay for a lease with the Bengals, and how long is the team even willing to extend the deal? Then we'll hear how Cincinnati homeowners are reacting to the city's new zoning plan. And tomorrow is the 150th Kentucky Derby. We'll discuss the investigations into last year's horse deaths at Churchill Downs. We're going to start by talking about the student protests. Joining me now is Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau Bureau Chief Karen Kassler. Welcome back, Karen.
Hi, great to be here.
Great to have you, as always. Student protesters, as I mentioned, nationwide and here in Ohio are calling on universities to divest from Israel. This idea of divesting any university dollars that go to Israel, explain what state law has to say about that.
Well, there are two laws that are involved in this. In 2016, a law was passed. Ohio became the 14th state that banned state agencies from boycotting Israel or from entering into contracts with companies that have anti-Israel policies. And that was in law starting in 2016, but then in 2022, that was expanded to include public universities. So that's where the law is right now. And the calls by students for public universities to divest from Israel or companies related to Israel, according to state law, they can't do that.
Hmm. And you talked with the Republican state lawmaker who wrote a bill related to free speech on campus. Tell us about that bill.
Well, that's Senator Jerry Serino. He actually wrote the law or sponsored the law that was updated that included public universities in this boycott and divestment effort. And Serino has sponsored a bill called Senate Bill 83, and it is a sweeping bill that will make some changes that conservatives specifically want in higher education that they say would address their concerns about not being able to express their free speech rights on campus. And I spoke to him about that since he's an advocate. He talks about being an advocate of free speech and whether more legislation would be needed on this. And he said he's watching what's happening.
Hmm. Senator Serino told you he thinks the student protesters are being urged on by professors he calls Marxist.
I don't believe actually that most of the student protesters actually even know where Gaza is or the historical nature of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
You also spoke with Sarah Kilpatrick with the Ohio Conference of the American Association of University Professors, which denounces Ohio State University's response to the protests.
I think you're hearing a frustrated lawmaker who hasn't been able to get his deeply unpopular Senate Bill 83 passed, and he's lashing out at students and faculty.
Do you have a sense, Karen, that Senator Serino could end up making changes to his proposed legislation as a result of these protests?
Well, one of the things, the thing that he said there is that a lot of these protesters are being urged on by others. I mean, that's something that we're hearing in the criticism of the protest is that many of these are not students. Many of these people who are out there are not students. They're outside people who are either being bused in or being paid to be there or whatever. But I would note that colleges and universities have long been a place where people have come to protest and to share concerns about what's happening in the world. I mean, this weekend, we're going to be remembering the 54th anniversary of the shootings at Kent State University. And that was an anti-Vietnam War protest. And so certainly there are students who are involved in these protests, but there are also people who are not students who are involved in these protests. Last week at Ohio State, there were 16 students who were arrested in a protest on Thursday night, and 20 people who are not students or faculty or affiliated with Ohio State who were also arrested. So I think Serena says he's going to be watching what happens here, and says, as many people have said, students and those who are protesting have the right to do it peacefully, but laws must be enforced. And that's what we're hearing from a lot of public officials who are not denouncing the protest, the reaction to the protests. Mm.
Yeah, you also heard from Senator Sherrod Brown in a call with reporters. Let's hear what he had to say.
I think that fundamentally that anti-Semitism and hate and violence are unacceptable on campuses. Students want to make their voices heard. They need to do it in a way that's nonviolent. They need to do it in a way that doesn't spew hatred. And the laws need to be enforced.
Sounds like that kind of mirrors what you're hearing from a lot of people, Karen. Is that right?
Yeah, and I think Democrats are in a tough spot on this one nationally, because there are certainly a lot of progressives who are very sympathetic to the pro-Palestinian cause, and a lot of those progressives are in the Democratic base. So I think you do have Democrats who are in tough re-election bids, like Sherrod Brown, who are really trying to figure out what is the way they want to say some of these things. And of course, Brown got pushback from his Republican opponent, Bernie Moreno. He put out a statement that accuses Sherrod Brown of siding with the illegal encampments and anti-Israel demonstrators, which kind of goes against what Sherrod Brown had said, that he wants to see protesters protest peacefully, and that's fine with him.
Are people expecting these protests to stop after final exams for this term and graduation?
I think that's probably the hope of a lot of colleges and university administrations. Senator Serino told me that he expects some of this to wind down as schools start to go to commencement and end for the year. That doesn't, again, necessarily mean that there won't be any encampments or demonstrations, because, like I said, there are people who are not students or faculty members who have been showing up, but that might shift the demonstration venues to other public spaces. I mean, I'm thinking of in the summer of 2020 after the George Floyd killing, and how there were demonstrations not just on campuses, but certainly in downtowns and in other spaces around Ohio and around the country. But this is the end of the year, and right now no Ohio college or university has suspended any activities related to commencement. And certainly the hope is that they won't be, because a lot of the kids that are graduating this year, if you're getting a four-year degree and you're graduating this year, you were in the class of 2020 in high school that missed your high school graduation. So that's certainly something to think about.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk to you about another important issue you've been following this week. There's been, I guess you could call it some chaos between Republicans or among Republicans in the Ohio House this week. Tell us about the six lawmakers who were removed from the committees they chair.
I think this is a continuation of what we've seen over the last year and a half at this point, almost. The background of this, of course, is that Speaker Jason Stevens became Speaker with the votes of 22 Republicans and all 32 Democrats, where 43 Republicans voted for his rival for Speaker, Representative Derek Marin. And that battle over House leadership has simmered throughout this legislative session. And some people are saying this is part of the reason that the legislature has passed so few bills and really hasn't moved on a lot of big pieces of legislation other than, say, the two-year state budget. But this week, Speaker Jason Stevens said that looking at the campaign finance reports for the March primary that were filed last week, he had some concerns about some Republicans who had given money to challengers of Republican incumbents in the primary. And he said that showed that they're not unified in the caucus, and he wants the caucus to be unified. So six of those committee chairs were removed from their committees for their donations to challengers to sitting Republican lawmakers. And many of those lawmakers were supporters of Jason Stevens, and four of them lost their primary elections. And the response from one of the chairs, Representative Plummer, who's the former Montgomery County Sheriff, he was very concerned about that, said he thinks it's childish behavior, he thinks it's illegal, and he is considering filing an ethics complaint.
That is there a precedent for an ethics complaint like that? I mean, is this something that's happened before, at least in the time that you've covered the State House?
Well, I haven't seen anything specifically like this, but we're kind of in an unusual situation here. I mean, as Speaker, Stevens has the authority to remove chairs from committees whenever he sees fit. But it's the idea that he did this tied to the donations that these particular chairs made that Plummer says makes it illegal. He says it's, you can't mix politics and policy. And so that's where he says that the problem lies. But Stephen says he needs to do what needs to be done to maintain unity in his caucus. He's obviously, we're going into an election here in November. And there's also a legal fight over who controls the campaign account that Ohio House Republicans have to get their own candidates elected. And I guess if indeed the mayor and supporters get control, it could get outside Republican candidates elected. Mm-hmm. And that's a legal battle's going on that, and that won't be decided until October.
What's next with all this, this dispute among these Republicans in the House?
Well, Plummer says he has a legal opinion that he is the person who can control the campaign account, and that the caucus voted last month that he should be the one who controls the campaign account. But there is a judge's order that says nobody's going to, that Stevens, the speaker, is in control of the campaign account. Nobody's going to change that until October when trial on this case goes forward. So right now we're in kind of a holding pattern, but it really shows the division among supermajority Republicans in the House. And the other part of that is, of course, in the Senate, you've got Senate President Matt Huffman, who's running unopposed for the House. And so he's going to be coming in and challenging Stevens as Speaker. He also gave money to challengers of lawmakers who supported Stevens. So it's a real leadership battle among Republicans with Stevens and Huffman at the top of it.
Hmm. Well, I know you'll keep following, and we appreciate that. I've been talking with Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler. Thank you so much for your time today, Karen.
It's always great to be on. Thanks for the invitation.
Up next, how long will the Bengals' new lease be for Paycor Stadium? We'll hear the latest. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Correspondence between the Cincinnati Bengals and Hamilton County indicates the two sides have a way to go when it comes to inking a new lease deal for Paycor Stadium. We're going to talk about the latest on those negotiations, along with what could happen to some city-owned land near transit routes, and how Cincinnati homeowners are reacting to the city's Connected Communities zoning proposal. Joining me now to do all that are Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich. Welcome back, Chris.
Thanks for having me, Lucy.
Great to have you. And WVXU general assignment and long-form reporter Nick Swartzell. Thanks for being here, Nick.
Thanks, Lucy.
Chris, news has been heating up around the lease negotiations between Hamilton County and the Bengals regarding Paycor Stadium. You wrote the two sides appear pretty far apart on a key element of the lease. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I had a column, I think it was April 30th, just basically kind of outlining something that I noticed in the correspondence between the two of them. Basically, when the Bengals talk about a lease extension at this point, they are talking about something that is a decade or less. In one case, they said 5 years. And when Hamilton County, which owns the stadium, talks about it, they talk about it in decades. And the current lease is about a quarter century. And so it makes sense for the county to want to lock them up for a good long while if they end up spending hundreds of millions of dollars or more to rehabilitate this stadium. But it's just been particularly notable that the Bengals have kind of, you know, said what they've said. You know, when the report on how much work is going to need to be done at the stadium, which is nearly $500 million, at least at this point, they talked about it in decades as well. But they've kind of gone to the singular iteration of that word. And so it's something that is noticeable and I think concerning probably.
So the county's talking in terms of decades, plural. The team is saying decade, singular. What are some of the other factors that could be playing into the team's timing?
Yeah, I think when you look at the two major things that cost the NFL money, NFL teams money, and bring in money, you note that those are things that don't last for more than 10 years. So you basically got the players union contract, for example, it runs through 2030. And so that's roughly seven years away. The television rights, which are, you know, extremely lucrative for the NFL, those contracts with CBS, ABC, Fox, NBC, and Amazon, they run through 2033, which is about 10 years away. So if you connect the dots there, which is kind of what I was trying to do, you note that those are two things that that fall within a decade, right? So perhaps the Bengals do not want to do something that extends out beyond that.
We talked last week on the program about how the Bengals were asking for the county to commit to $300 million for a 5-year extension, and the Bengals would kick in $50 million. How does that compare to what's happening in other NFL markets like Baltimore?
You know, when we talk about Baltimore, they are in the pro. I think they've signed the lease extension, or they're okay with it. And so it's a $600 million renovation of the Baltimore Stadium, and that extends the lease. It just depends on how you look at it. The Bengals look at it as they're really only extending it 10 years because, they have the current 4 or 5 years left on Baltimore's lease with Maryland. And then they're extending it another 10 years. Some others say, okay, well, it's a 15-year extension because it's a new deal. And going forward, that's how long it's going to last from this day forward. So it's a little bit of semantical argument, but, the upshot is Baltimore Ravens will be there for 15 more years from now. And the other thing to think about when it comes to the Baltimore lease that's important is that the Baltimore Ravens pay the game day expense. The expenses of running the stadium. That is an expense that Hamilton County taxpayers currently pay. And it's roughly $8, $9 million a year.
Okay. An op-ed in the Inquirer this week by Christopher Wood said, quote, "At some point, you just have to ask, aren't they ashamed when it's now widely known how bad of an investment publicly funded stadiums are, when most of the new NFL stadiums in the past few years have been built primarily with private money, when just down the road, the new FC Cincinnati stadium was overwhelmingly financed by the team and not the taxpayer? Aren't they ashamed?" End quote. What are some of the sentiments among the public about these negotiations?
I haven't done any kind of polling or sat down at a diner and talked to people. So I'm a little bit reluctant to, go too deep into that. But that is not an unusual position. The Wall Street Journal wrote many, many years ago, this was the worst stadium deal in history. The Bengals dispute that pretty vociferously as well. So, but that Wall Street Journal story, and there's a New York Times story as well around that same time, they have left a mark with the public. They have, their public, I think, generally thinks that we got a bad deal or we could have gotten a better deal. And the national media has repeatedly kind of said, we're a bunch of suckers for this. So, but to that letter writer's argument, on the flip side, when you talk about publicly or privately financed stadiums, the one that really comes to mind are, in Los Angeles and Dallas, and those are humongous NFL markets, right? The state of California has basically said, we are not building NFL stadiums anymore. And if you're the NFL, you need to be in the nation's largest state. So guess what? You suck it up and you pay the money. Whether they need to be in Cincinnati, no one's gone down that road again, which Lucy, you remember, of course, was...
Well,
if you want us, you're going to have to pay up to keep us. And so we haven't reached that point yet. I don't know if we will. I don't know if, cooler heads on both sides will, we'll get something done here in the next year or so, but we're not quite there yet.
What about this comparison to FC Cincinnati and, how the fact that primarily private money paid for that? Do you have a sense for whether that's an apples to apples kind of comparison?
Soccer's different. I think it's growing, and I think in the future it will, it will have a greater impact in the national sports psyche. But the NFL is the big kahuna, right? There's so many eyeballs attuned to that every Sunday, and so an NFL team is arguably more valuable than a soccer team at this point. The thing I remember about FC though, too, as well, is they wanted more public money than they got, and the city, the county just showed no interest in it beyond, okay, we'll build you a garage. The city was more enthusiastic about it, but they also did not kick in any, money for the stadium itself. Both the city and the county put tens of millions, I have to look up the figure, I know it exceeds $50 million into infrastructure around FC Cincinnati's stadium. So it was not, in order for the stadium to go there, yes, there actually was public money there.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you referred to the fact that the county's original lease deal with the Bengals has been the subject of a lot of criticism. We've gotten the county's gotten some heat from the national media for sure. What are county commissioners saying they want to do differently this time around?
The main thing that is repeated and kind of there's unanimity, excuse me, behind this from all three Democrats who control this commission is they want a diversified stream of money going into any renovation. And that means they want the team to put in money. They want the NFL to put in money. They want the state of Ohio to put in more money. Last time, the taxpayers of Hamilton County put in, you know, depending on how you measure and all that, you know, more than 80%, some would say 90%. But they put in the vast, vast, vast majority of the money. And the county commissioners do not want that to be the case this time.
Okay. Is there any indication the NFL is willing to contribute to stadium renovation costs? You talked about how, you know, the NFL desperately wants to be in California, but maybe isn't so desperate or as desperate to be here.
You know, they have contributed elsewhere to new stadiums in Buffalo and Nashville. Nashville, obviously growing. Buffalo, a very mature, small, very small market compared to Cincinnati, but with a great fan base in the state of New York. So, you know, we've seen indications that they'll contribute to other stadiums, but we have not heard any commitments that they will do so here. You also have to consider, we talked a little bit about this on X / Twitter, however you want to call it, but Cleveland is also in the same boat. They are looking at whether to build a new stadium or to renovate their existing stadium. And it was clear this week from a scoop out of Cleveland that they're going to want a lot of state money as well. So I think some of this is going to be a state house issue in terms of the expectation from these two, you know, our two largest metropolitan areas, that the state come up with more money than it did last time for these stadiums.
And what are the lawyers for the team telling you about these negotiations? I know you said they argue vociferously that taxpayers didn't get a raw deal with the original lease. What are you hearing from them with this?
This is in the public letters as well, but I mean, they feel like there's a little bit of slow walking this. There's, you know, the letter from Troy Blackburn, for example, you know, said, oh, I don't know if there's the political will for this, right? Which is, you know, a little bit of saber rattling. So, you know, I think they're frustrated at the pace of this and would like to really get into it. The county's contention is, well, what we want to see is the master plan for the entire site to really upgrade it. And before we enter into heavy duty negotiations, we want to see that. And so just to understand what that is, it's different from the $493 million in, you know, needs that the stadium had over 20 years. This is a report that will overlap a little bit with that, but also kind of say, here's what we really need to do to make this a state-of-the-art football palace for the future. And, the county commissioners have been waiting on that for a while. I think we expected it last year. It still is taking too long, I think. So, but we are told that it will come next month. So we'll see.
Okay. Well, we've been talking about Hamilton County. Nick, let's shift to the city of Cincinnati. We both know people who'd like to rely less on their cars. They want to be able to live affordably and still be able to get to where they need to go. Tell us how the city of Cincinnati is working on that.
Yeah, so this is something that I saw from the city manager's office that I think is really interesting. So the city owns about 74 acres of land that are on or very near transit corridors. So that could be existing bus routes that are really busy or the coming bus rapid transit projects that Metro is working on right now. And that land, what some members of council asked the city to do is, hey, like, give us a report about what this land is, where it is, and what we could do with it. And that report just recently came back from the Department of Community and Economic Development. And they found that there are about 22 plots out of that 74 acres, roughly about an acre, acre and a half average, that are, you know, pretty ready for development. And so the city's looking into how do we get these developed? And that is one of the things that it could be developed for is housing. Could mm-hmm. also be commercial space. Maybe office space, but I think it sounds like the city's like really focusing on mixed use or housing, and maybe some commercial space on the first floor of some of these. So,
yeah. What's on this land now?
This land, so these plots specifically, it's either a vacant lot where maybe a building was at one point, or it's like surface parking lots. So usually I don't think, looking through, I didn't see any thing that had structures on it is all kind of vacant.
Okay. Who are the council members who are really pushing for this, and what are you hearing from them? What's their rationale that, hey, the city needs to figure out if we can do something with this land?
Yeah, so this time last year, Mark Jeffries kind of like submitted a motion to have the city look at this. Council members Mika Owens and Reggie Harris also signed on to that. They're both also big proponents of this. And the idea is like, listen, you know, as we're moving along some of these other, you know, initiatives, including connected communities, they're all about density. They're about rolling back parking regulations in some places, parking requirements. What else can we do to help build density, help build affordability in the city? And I think this is some of that idea.
Okay. What kind of resources can the city use to make this happen?
So the city's process is that they're going to be releasing this, you know, request for proposals for some of these plots at some point in the future. And as they do, they're going to be reminding developers who might be applying for these that there are federal funds through the U.S. Department of Transportation. Most of these are loan programs that would finance the building of housing or other sort of developments along transit lines. And there's like tens of billions of dollars available in these loans, you know, but that's across the country. But developers could apply for some of that money.
Sure. And you mentioned that the 22 of these sites, I think you said, are the best shots for possible development. Which are the first sites being targeted for this?
So there are four sites that DCED, that's the Department of Community and Economic Development, has really singled out as like, we should get requests for proposals out for these first. One is Hugh Street and Schiller Street. That's in Over the Rhine, kind of like off of Main Street, just north of Liberty. There have been some various plans for that land in the past. And, you know, the city's really leaving it open about what would happen there. But it's right now there's some trees. There's a little community garden in part of it, I think. But it is less dense than the rest of the neighborhood, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are a couple on Reading Road, which is where the 43 goes through. The best transit route, I think, in the city right now, but I'm biased.
Wow, those are strong words from Nick Swartzel.
I'm going to hear about it on Twitter for that
one.
Yeah,
you are.
All the 17 fans out there. But but those are in Avondale and North Avondale. That's also where one of the bus rapid transit routes is going to go through. And then there's a smaller plot in Madisonville, on Kenwood Road that they're talking about as well.
Okay. What's next with this? Is the city going to be involving the communities where this property is located?
Yeah, that's kind of the next step, is doing some real community engagement in these places to find out sort of what folks who live around the area think about possible development, what kind of development they would like to see if they're, you know, for development there, and, you know, kind of feeling that out as developers also kind of submit their ideas.
Okay. Well, speaking about reaching out to communities, Chris, I've got to say, you do not see the word excoriated used in a lot of news stories, but it's the fifth word in your report about a city planning staff public engagement session on the Connected Communities Plan. Remind us of what Connected Communities is all about, and tell us who excoriated what.
Well, Lucy, I don't think we have 2 hours, but I'll give you the short version of Connected Communities. The basic idea in a sentence or two or three is that along the city's transit routes and in its neighborhood business districts, the city plans to, I'm going to use a dirty word, upzone a little bit what is going, you know, what is able to go there. And it, upzone it in the sense of, you know, if they're, you know, you can put basically a 2 or 3 or 4 unit apartment there. And this is all subject to the details of the plan, right? The city actually has a pretty good website showing exactly what could go on each plot of land in the entire city under this plan. And so it also, you know, removes things or lightens parking requirements and allows some height differentials from what the current zoning code allows. So the idea is to allow people to build a little bit more density along these routes and to make this a more kind of transit friendly, walking friendly areas of the city. And so that's kind of the upshot of it. The meeting that I covered earlier, or it was either earlier this week or last week, there were two meetings recently, this is called the Connected Communities Plan. So it was a meeting by the planning department staff because this is about to go to the Planning Commission. And so before those meeting, before the Planning Commission actually takes a vote, the planning staff has an engagement session with the public. And in this case, they're having two of them. And so at each meeting, there were dozens of people speaking about the changes proposed, and almost to the one that I listened to, almost a, you know, almost all of them were opposed to this, the people that actually spoke. There were two supporters in that meeting that I covered. And so their concerns are not surprising, because the city has actually done a lot of engagement before they even, you know, released the plan. And generally, single family homeowners are very skeptical of this. And that was pretty much the case of the people who spoke. They were overwhelmingly single family homeowners. They were concerned about parking. They were concerned about more crime. They were concerned about having more people live around them.
So is the concern more about parking or about having multifamily rental properties in what have been communities filled with single family homes?
All of the above, basically. Okay. And so, you know, it was interesting. I mean, you just said that a lot of these places have, you know, single family homes, and they do. But I mean, the people that we generally heard from were from North Avondale, Hyde Park, Mount Lookout, some from Clifton. These are all places that already have some multifamily housing that's been scattered about and grandfathered in under the current zoning code, because you wouldn't tell an apartment building when you rewrote the zoning code that they had to demolish it. So these folks already live around multifamily housing. And so I do think they fear that there will be more built, basically. And I think there's another fear that has been in the city for a long time, which is that in Hyde Park and Mount Lookout and some of the East Side communities, what they've seen happen is developers will come in, they will tear down a historic, nice looking home, and they will build, you know, what is pejoratively called a McMansion that doesn't really fit in the rest of the neighborhood. And so there is concern that this will make that easier, that kind of thing easier.
And remind me again, which neighborhoods were represented in this meeting you covered? Where were people coming from or talking from?
Yeah, North Avondale was a big one, Mount Washington, Hyde Park, Clifton. And there were some, I neglected the West Side folks who are also in there, and they have different concerns. West Price Hill and East Price Hill as well were in the meeting that I heard. And their concern mainly is that the landlords that they have there now, they don't trust them. And a lot of the landlords on the West Side are, you know, institutional investors, folks who have bought vast amounts of single family homes, and both the residents, the Port of Greater Cincinnati Development Authority, and the city itself don't believe that they've done a particularly good job renting to those folks, keeping up the homes, you know, keeping them into code, and generally providing a nice living environment. They think that they have let those homes go to pot. And so they are extremely concerned about additional rental housing coming to their neighborhoods.
Is there anything in connected communities that would dissuade institutional investors from being part of this?
No, there isn't. I mean, this is a zoning change, so it's not a regulation in terms of who can own what.
Okay. What's next with this whole process?
So on May 17th, it will be in the Planning Commission. That's a Friday that starts at 9 usually. And it'll probably be an all-dayer, if not an all-nighter, as they consider this. And so once the Planning Commission votes, if they vote in favor of it, it will go to City Council. And that is where the final decisions will be made. The question, you know, if it doesn't get out of the Planning Commission, I think it's kind of on ice for the summer, because I don't think they have another meeting for a while.
So pack your lunch for that meeting, Chris. That sounds like it could be a long one.
And your dinner. You better send us some pizza, Lucy.
You know I'm good for pizza, Chris. What about if it does make it out of the Planning Commission? How quickly could City Council take this up?
I think, and remember, this is Mayor Aftab Purval's proposal. He's the one sponsoring it, along with Reggie Harris, the councilman. He's a major supporter of this. So they, in their mind, I think, want to have it voted on and passed by the end of June, when council breaks for the summer.
Well, okay, I know you're not a betting man, Chris, but what are the odds?
With government and votes like this on a major initiative, I always bet for delay. But, you know, I think that just the comments that I've heard the mayor and Councilman Harris make is they're not going wobbly on it. So I think that they want it to pass, and they want it to pass in June. And, you know, this could be the first major policy that we see a 5-4 vote on, which has been very unusual in the city council, given that all 9 of them are Democrats and they generally are rowing in the same direction.
Okay. Well, I've been talking with Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich and WVXU general assignment and long-form reporter Nick Swartzel. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thanks, Lucy.
Thank you.
Up next, Saturday marks the 150th Kentucky Derby. We'll hear what's happened with all the investigations into last year's horse deaths at Churchill Downs. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Saturday is the 150th Kentucky Derby, often referred to as the most exciting 2 minutes in sports. But last year's race was marked by the deaths of 12 horses at Churchill Downs. Joining me in this recorded interview to discuss what's happened since then is Courier Journal Enterprise reporter Stephanie Kuzdem. Welcome back, Stephanie.
Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, thanks for being here. I know you're busy. Saturday's Derby Day, as I mentioned, last year at this time, we were talking about all these horse deaths. Remind us, when did these deaths start at the track last year?
They started around April 27th of last year, in the lead up to the Derby, and they just kept going on Derby Day. They continued, and then one was on Mother's Day, and they kept going until they Churchill Downs made the historic decision to actually shut down the track and review the racing surface. And that was about a month later. So June was when they finally made that decision to shut down the track.
Wow. And you said that's a historic decision. I mean, that's not something that happens much at Churchill Downs, is it?
And nobody could tell me whether that had ever happened before. It's not something they want happening. They did move all of those races to another location that Churchill Downs owns in Western Kentucky. But yeah, it's very unlike, nobody wants to shut down a racetrack and not have horses race on it.
Mm. And there were 12 horses in all that died last year. Such a tragic outcome. Track officials said they were going to do a top to bottom review of their practices and racing surface. What did they do? What did they find?
Yeah, so they called in some of the premier racetrack surface experts to come and do a review of the makeup of the track surface. So they did all sorts of like scientific things, including like ground radar penetration on it, just to see how the actual track was and if stuff was coming up from the surface to the top. It also did a review of they walked the surface, they took samples of the surface. There's a lab in Lexington that took those samples and took them over the consistency, or reviewed them for the consistency over previous years of sampling it. And nobody found really anything that they could point to in the track or in the necropsies of the horses that said, this is the thing that caused it.
So these investigations, did any of them find anything, any common thread among all these horse deaths?
It didn't seem like there was one conclusive common thread at all. HISA, which is the Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Authority, it is a agency that oversees horse racing now. It's brand new. And it did an investigation and a review. And it recommended that Churchill Downs basically sift through its entire racing surface because one of the things that trainers had been telling us was that there were rocks in the track. And rocks in a track are not that they go hand in hand, but they're not something that is completely uncommon. There's gravel on the backside. Horse hooves can bring it on. Track, like the equipment can bring it on. The equipment that harrows the track, the tractors and stuff. So HISA did recommend that Churchill Downs sift through all of the dirt surface and then basically to find those track, and then any new surface that it bring on to basically sift through that surface as well.
And is that being done now?
They did that. Yes, they did that before the start of this meet.
Okay. Okay. How common is it for horses to collapse on a racetrack?
Well, a breakdown of a horse has obviously happened since Grantland Rice even wrote like a famous piece about it. But when you have 12 in one meet, that was what was uncommon. And this is kind of appeared in the horse racing industry where there's this spate of deaths that happened at Santa Anita in California. I think it was 2019, where there was like a rash of deaths and they couldn't figure out what it was. And then it happened at Churchill Downs, and it all happens. And what I mean by a meet is they have so many weeks of racing at Churchill Downs, the industry moves from track to track. So like no races ran at Churchill Downs over the winter. But now it's their spring, what they refer to as their spring meet. So during that time to have so many deaths was what really had everybody worried.
Sure. What changes has Churchill Downs made to try to ensure the safety of the horses that race there?
So their changes have kind of ranged from like the mundane to like a little more intricate, I guess. So some things like they changed the way they rake the track. And then they've obviously brought on new dirt. The trainers have all commented on the fact that it's a different makeup. It seems to be completely different. It's darker. So they think that there's a little more clay in it. But nobody has been able to tell me so far, like what that necessarily means. And they actually did look at their turf track as well. There weren't as many deaths on the turf track, but there were, I think, one if not two last year. And the turf track had been redone right before the 2022 spring meet. And a horse, a three-year-old, broke down during that meet, and Churchill had shut down the course to review its surface. And then last year there was the death during the spring meet, and then during the fall meet trainers were saying that horses were slipping on that course, and what that means is like their hooves aren't grabbing the turf, and instead it's like ripping up the turf, and they're slipping, so they're not able to go forward as well. And so the final 3 days of Churchill's fall meet, they actually moved all races that were supposed to be on the turf track onto the dirt track. And that's like kind of saying like you're a runner and you run better on concrete than you do gravel or grass. That's the difference. Like not all turf horses like running on the dirt. That's why they're turf horses. So that was really frustrating to a lot of the trainers, also for the safety of the horses. So a lot of them just ended up pulling their horses out of those races. So Churchill did a review of the turf track as well. So when they say top to bottom review, they did it of both tracks, of the equipment, of the practices of the track crew and how they were going around. And then they had these experts come in and really review these surfaces with them. So it's been a lot of changes. I think that we probably don't even know all of them and will never know all of them. I just learned of another one last week with a new track advisory committee to HISA that comes in and reviews the track now ahead of a meet. And that I just learned in HISA's latest newsletter. So,
and you mentioned the dirt on the dirt track being, and I'm probably using the wrong term, but the dirt track being darker, that trainers are telling you there's something different in it. They don't know exactly what, maybe more clay. Did Churchill Downs change anything with the turf track? I mean, that turf coming up on the horses, that almost sounds like horse hydroplaning. That sounds like it can be dangerous.
Yeah, so I spoke with a member of, after all of these horse deaths, Churchill Downs created a advisory committee of trainers and other members of the track. So basically they were able to get real-time feedback from the trainers, which they hadn't had in the past. And that one of the trainers told me that they spent the entire winter just really reviewing that turf surface, and they had lights on it to make sure that it would grow, and like a tarp to make sure that it would really grow and those seeds would get down deep and it would have better growth in order to help. But it's raining here in Louisville today. So it's Oaks Day. Friday is Oaks Day. It's supposed to rain tomorrow on Derby Day. And so they have already, Churchill Downs has already pulled one race from the turf to the dirt. Mm.
Is it unsafe? You know a lot more about horse racing than I do. I know it sure looks messy when horses run in the rain, when the muck and the mud. Is that less safe for horses and jockeys?
Well, it's more challenging, which I guess could lead to being less safe. It depends on a few factors, right? How much rain there is, how well the track is draining that rain, which I was told this morning that the track surface actually, Churchill is known, the dirt surface is known for actually draining very well. But yeah, when you're riding on a horse and you have essentially like two toes holding on and that horse is going 40 miles an hour and you're over the top of it and there's mud coming up in your face, not just dirt, but mud, and it's coming onto your goggles. Yeah, it's way more challenging than a typical sunny race day.
Yeah, sure sounds like it. So overall, what is Churchill Downs saying about track safety this year?
That is a great question. They haven't actually said a whole lot to us. It kind of seems like it was something that happened in 2023. They would like to leave it in 2023. They have obviously been in communication with HISA to make these changes, but it is not something that has been heavily addressed at all. All eyes have kind of been on the fact that this is the 150th Kentucky Derby, and there's a brand new paddock. And so they've spoken a lot about that, but about the track, you have to dig a little bit to get anybody to talk a whole lot about it. Mostly the trainers do. They've had a bucket brigade out there, which is people who have gone and actually picked up any rocks that they have seen. But besides that, there's not a whole lot of information around it.
Well, we appreciate the information you've given us. I've been talking with Courier Journal Enterprise reporter Stephanie Cousadim. Thank you so much for your time, Stephanie.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. If you miss our program live, you can subscribe to Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening.